Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. Thanks for downloading this or listening to it, however you are listening to it. In this episode, I talked to Sarah Jane Barnett, whose new book of poetry, Work, we looked at last episode. And this week, Sarah Jane and I have a chat about Anne Kennedy's The Time of the Giants, which is a fantastic book, and you'll hear all about it. It's pretty straightforward. I don't really need to explain much about it in the introduction. It's one of the more straightforward episodes we've done for a while, and it's great. It was really nice to talk to Sarah Jane. We had a great chat. I thought I would just take a moment to say we are on Twitter. We are also on Facebook. And also, if you're listening to us through iTunes, it would be awesome if you could rate us or rank us or however they call it there, or leave a comment. That'd be really good. Thanks heaps for all the people that do that. The way to find out about all that stuff is probably on our WordPress site, which is betterrednz.wordpress.com. And of course, red is R-E-A-D, not the colour. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks. All right, so this is a part of the poem just after Moss and Paul have had one of their sexual encounters, but they're still together. Then everything fell away. The coats in the hall, the cloth wrung out raining into the sink, the gymnasium floor, the dinners eaten to the chiming of a clock, clothes on their backs, and how they got there, and now they are gone, the very clothes fallen away, and the works of Shakespeare, and poets in general, now dissolved, droplets. But hello, now they've moved to the factory floor. A machine is going and going and going late into the night, which might require a second shift of workers at some point, fresh with enthusiasm. The shape of a petal she tried to brush from the sheet, but it wouldn't come. It was heavy, and her body, and his probably, became weightless and colourless and of no height and no history, merely a string bag to hold pleasure together. Okay, so here we are. It is a sunny day and we're at Victoria University, and I'm here with Sarah Jane Barnett. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good, thank you.
That's very good. And today we are going to be talking about The Time of the Giants by Anne Kennedy. This is an Auckland University Press book. And when did it come out?
I don't know.
Let's have a look. 2005. Whoa! So it's nearly 10 years old, and it's a brilliant book. And I read it because you recommended it to me. And
oh, cool.
I think I read it
because Harry Ricketts recommended it to me when I was years ago. It must have been a few years after it came out, because I was interested in long poems and long narrative poems. And he said, read Anne Kennedy. And so I did.
Yeah.
And yeah, I read it once back then, and then I read it again for this podcast, and it had the same experience of, like, just, like, gripping me for the whole thing.
It's quite incredible then, isn't it? Like, I was thinking, I think I always ask this of a long poem, and I always ask this of kind of a narrative poem as well. Like, what and no matter how I ask it, I'm privileging one form over the other, but what does a long poem give you that a novel doesn't? Or what? Yeah, let's start there.
Yeah.
What does a long poem give you that a novel doesn't?
I think that's a good question. And one that I think about all the time, because I want to write a novel, a book-length poem, so, you know, I have to know, what am I trying to do with this? But I think, and I'm sure people will disagree with me, that in a novel you want the writing to disappear. You want the reader to be completely immersed in the world of the novel. Whereas with a poem, I think you want the language to come to the forefront. So it's always present, so you always are focusing on those poetic techniques. And I think for me that's the difference. So you can still have, like, characters and dialogue, and I mean, in this The Time of the Giants, you know, the story is about a giantess, or Moss, and I mean, she's 7'4" or something,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
really tall, but you're not quite sure whether she is actually just a tall, really tall woman, or if she's actually a giant. Like, there's that wonderful kind of play with, you know, myth and reality. But she's, you know, she's, it's her story, and but the writing is still so focused on language, and how language builds realities. So I think that's the difference. There's a difference for me anyway. I know, like, with my own poems, and I think if you, like, took Anne Kennedy's or any other poet who wrote long poems, if you took all the line breaks out, it wouldn't make... And I've done this. I did this once with a story during... with a story, with a poem. The Freudian slip there. when we were having discussions during my my doctoral thesis about whether a particular poem was a short story or not, I took all the line breaks out to see if it would work. And it was... It just didn't work. It just didn't, you know, because the line breaks create pressure around the language and create, you know, those double meanings. And I noticed that a lot in The Time of the Giants, that sort of, like, play with syntax. And you'll read, you know, in the line breaks, suddenly you'll get one sentence that is meaning kind of three different things. And so, yeah, it's that continual attention to language.
And almost like, it's almost like writing with white space as well, isn't it? Like, I mean, that's the real sense I get with it as well, is that, there's so much in the line break. And even, I was even imagining that if you did put it together, not only would it lose that pressure, but there is something so different about that language compared with a short story. And I think you're dead right. I think that... Often in fiction, we are trying to make the language disappear, you know. Like,
yeah.
We want people to kind of run through it like it's really easy. And I think that that's what I find really enjoyable about a long poem like this, is that it does catch me up occasionally, you know what I mean? Like, occasionally I am going back and reading other lines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really like that it is very aware of its form of a poem. Like, there are lots of... Like lots of parts in it where it actually refers to itself as a poem, and there's like there's this really even Anne, like the author's voice comes through. Like, this is one part where when Moss is going out with Paul, this average sized man that she's met. So she meets him and she's shelving like the large books on the bottom shelf in the library. I always imagine her working in Wellington, in like Central Library. I don't know why.
Because I always imagine her working in that library that used to be near Eastgate in Christchurch. Oh. It's so weird, eh? Like, I always think of it being like one of those... Yeah, I don't know why, but I was just like, yep, this is the Eastgate. Like, I don't even know what it's called. I don't hear him say Eastgate.
Imagine her in Wellington Central Library. And so, yeah, he meets her and she is, you know, on her knees, so he doesn't know how tall she is. And it's just so crazy that, yeah, through all their dates, she manages to avoid standing, so she can be, you know, this ordinary. Trying to, like, I mean, the whole, like, theme of the book of trying to fit yourself into what you think is acceptable. But when she goes out on the first date, she makes herself this beautiful blue dress, and the lines are, her clothes cling custom-made, like the earth's atmosphere, but who cares? I do. And then I see the I do as Anne's voice, and it's also Moss's voice, and it's, but it's like that interesting, you're like, suddenly you're like, who's talking there? And then the poem, like, you know, breaks down to these layers of reality. So there is the reality of the poem, and I think that's, I think a lot about why Anne Kennedy wrote this poem as the sort of mythic, you know, it kind of starts out of this myth of the giants, and also ends in that sort of kind of mythic language as well. Yeah. And then there's also the level of reality. And I wonder if it is because she wants to kind of point to the way that writing creates these realities, you know, so in a novel, when you're reading it and it does all drop away and you're just like right in there and it feels real, and then you kind of surface out of it. I think in the poem it's trying to make it feel really real, but then make you look at it and go, oh, I am being absorbed by this completely fictional thing and it feels incredibly real to me. Because I got to get to the end and I just have a real emotional reaction to it. And then I go, oh, I'm having an emotional reaction to something that's not real. You know, like, and then what does that mean? And so, yeah, I just, it's such a clever book in that way.
I so love that idea. You're kind of blowing my mind a little bit because I sort of, you know what I mean? Like, I do, you know, like, my favourite reading experience is where, that I'm never, where I'm never allowed to forget that I'm reading a book. Like, it's just, it's my favourite. I don't know why. I just love that feeling where I am constantly aware that this is an artifice and... You know, like, I, you know, the, and yet to bridge that and then get an emotional response is just huge, isn't it?
I think that, I mean, I think that's like the magic trick. Because yeah. I think it's really easy to write, it's not easy to write a poem ever, but I think it's, I think it's easier to write a poem that says, I'm a poem.
Yes.
You know, but to make you care as well,
mm.
I think is the hard thing. And that's, yeah, that's all the writing I'm interested in as well. Like, that's why, Cormac McCarthy's The Road is my favourite novel, because I'm completely immersed in that world, but also the lack of punctuation and the use of, like, the characters don't have names. They just kind of stand in for all men and all boys, and so you're always really aware that both these things are happening at the same time.
Mm.
And I noticed that Anne Kennedy also doesn't use love. In this book here, it doesn't use much punctuation either.
Mm.
So it's almost like the stream of consciousness. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Because I found it incredibly affecting. Like, I am, I live with a man who is 6'11".
Yeah.
I see the struggles of that. You know, like, people will often comment on height when they won't comment on weight or, you know, like, buck teeth or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. So I wondered if maybe I was artificially oversensitive to it, you know. And, you know, similarly, my daughter's extremely tall, like, she's double the size of a lot of her friends. But there is something so clever that this book seems to be saying to me about bodies. And just when you were saying before, like, this whole idea of her on her knees and trying to, you know, like,
yeah.
not being able to stand up, that very kind of metaphorically... you know, weighted kind of act
yeah,
of standing
yeah,
up,
definitely.
You know, and I just think it's just, and that interesting idea of the mythic versus the real and the strain of it is just quite incredible, eh?
I think, and this is something that I am always interested in, is the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and the way that shapes our perception of the world. And I think what I loved about this book was the way it was relatable to anybody who's kind of moving from one state to another state. So in the book,
yeah.
Moss moves from kind of like a girlhood, like, this is the first man she's ever slept with, the first man she's really had a relationship with, and all the mistakes, you know, they're so horribly ill-suited. There's a wonderful passage in the book where, you know, when you go on a first date with someone and you're getting to know them and you say, you know, do you like this? Have you read this? Have you seen this movie? And she asks him, I mean, it goes on for like 3 pages, she asks him all these questions, he goes, no.
Oh,
no,
yes,
no,
it's
no,
one of my favourite
no.
parts.
Yeah, and then at the end she's just so in love with him, when it's obvious that they're not well suited to each other, but she obviously has an idea of who she is meant to be, who she has to fit into.
Yeah.
What I really liked was the way that, this is such a gutsy book, because the kind of like the transformation, the part where... spoiler alert, where she stands up and finally, you know, and then of course this man who has never seen her standing freaks out and runs away. And then it's so funny, it's like so tragic and so funny at the same time. And then she later sees him with a, you know, like a normal sized, normal in air quotes, sized woman in a cafe, but she's like, she's strong in herself, like, she is fully embracing her height, but Kennedy leaves it right until the end. You know, like, it's so gutsy to, it's just in the final pages, and that, I think, is amazing to take us to that point. It really earns, you know, and then we get to see, like, kind of, it's a bit like the book, like Mr. Pip, you know, you get kind of the whole thing, and then you get, like, a short bit that covers a huge span of time, and
yeah
and it does the same thing, and shows how that idea, how the story she is telling about herself changes. But I think that maybe why she used the idea of the myth, like the self myth, the, you know, the, which, I, you know, gender, sexuality, you know, all sorts of types of identity, you know, like what is, for Moss, what is womanhood?
And for her,
a woman can't be 7 foot. They have to be like little, and yeah, she just wants to be little all the time. She tries to make herself small. And I think maybe that is the experience of many women of average height, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I am, I kind of, I was just thinking how, like, I always, every time I talk about this book, I make it sound really important and earnest, but it's a very funny book.
It's really funny.
Like, even the idea of the fact that when he meets her, she's shelving down low the oversized books.
Yeah.
She's kind of, her height is camouflaged in the oversized books. And just, I particularly enjoy the rugby bit at the end. It's just it's got to be some of the best writing about sport.
Like, it is.
It's just so good. And all the way through, it seems very body focused, and I was just thinking that at your launch last week, this was something that Hannah Moana commented on. I remember I was talking to Rachel and she commented on it. I talked to a couple of people that had read the book and they all commented on this, and I was just wondering, your thesis is about eco-poetics as well, and I'm just wondering, because this book, there's quite a key scene that takes place outside, you know, and deep in, you know, like greenery and the wild. But I'm just wondering, can you talk a little bit about the relationship of body and nature? Is that easy to talk about, or ridiculous?
No. It's I don't know if it's easy. I'll give it a go.
I just wrote a thesis on it.
For me, it is definitely about the humans as both thinking and instinctual animals.
Mm.
And that, I mean, the poetry that I love the most kind of goes into the body. You know, so I know, I mean, as a, like, all of my work is kind of thinking work, and I live so much in my head, but then, you know, I'm also driven by my body, you know, hunger and thirst and, you know, sex, and I just think it's a really fascinating way of existing. And yeah, I think that's why I write from the body, because the experience of, you know, of thought and the experience of gut are so different.
Mm. And I keep thinking, like, the Svalbard poem. Sorry, I am bad with
ghosts.
Titles.
Ghosts.
Thank you. I was just thinking, like, in a lot of, and the Woman and the Bear poem, which is called The Woman Who Married a Bear.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic as well, but I really like the way that and I don't know, I really love the way that tough environment plays on body and somehow seems to affect mind and psychology as well.
Yeah.
And I think a lot about you with your running as well.
Like the running the running poem in there.
Yeah.
And it made me think about, because looking at the form, that's something as well. I have been so unconsciously influenced by the Time of the Giants.
Mm.
It's just because in the book, her, like, a lot of the time the form will go like this: long line, short line, long line, short line, long line.
Yeah.
And that, I did that in running with my father kind of, and, you know, it was indented as well to suggest the gait of running. So much of the time I use form to suggest either movement or emotion, like emotional change. And Kennedy does that too. So when you get to the end where Moss stands up, the form changes totally. Or like in that part with the rugby game, all the lines are very even, like becomes the short and even and becomes extremely urgent. And there's a huge amount of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And which I also think is like that, you know, when you're young and you fall in love, you are so obsessed, usually, with your object of love that your mind returns to them again and again. And in the book, the language returns the same lines and the same words again and again. So you're getting like this, you're like, it's almost enacting the mind in love, which is amazing. And I don't know, I can't remember what the first question is.
I'm just... This is way more interesting than the first. But this thing of form, like, I am so fucking jealous all the time of poets. And I know that we can do it in fiction and yada, yada, yada. But
it's much harder to get away with without looking like a wanker.
Yes, I totally agree. I completely agree. And I must admit that
I'm expected to look like a wanker.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I think fiction writers, I don't know, I think we have a degree. The slippery slope to self-importance is a bit quicker, I think. And I know that, you know, and there is something, I do feel a little bit of love and commitment to the solid block of text as well, which is, and you've written in solid blocks.
Yeah,
as well.
And this collection here, 100 Traditional Smiles, so that was Kennedy's first in 1988. This is all for those at home, because I'm opening the book now. It's lots of fully justified blocks of text that are numbered, and this was marketed as a novella, but it's definitely it's definitely prose poetry for me.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
I might start doing that. I'm marketing it as a novella, just a very big fat novella.
Yeah, I like the bricks. Yeah, I like little bricks on a page.
Yeah, and this thing with form, which I always ask people with an art background this, but I think, do you think that part of you? Because what did you do at art school? What did you do at art school?
I went to a lot of parties.
Met some cool people.
Yeah, and not many lectures. I did photography. I majored in photography.
Oh, fantastic.
And I probably should have done sculpture, because I was too afraid.
Yeah.
But I was more interested in the sculptural form.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, for me, it is really important how things look on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
And Duncan Forbes, the designer for work, he and I thank you, Duncan. Very patient. But it was, I mean, every single little spacing in my book has been, you know, is deliberate.
Mm, yeah.
And there were lots of parts where, because when I wrote the book, obviously I'm writing on like an A4 page, so we had to squash things a little bit when we put it into book format. But I think we went through 7 revisions of the inside to get it exactly how I wanted it to feel. Mm. So for me, it's not just about the, you know, what the words mean, but how they look and the spacing and how they flow. So when very emotional moments happen for my characters, I want there to be space, and I want there to be white space, and I want there to be jumps and leaps and to sort of suggest that.
Mm.
So the reading experience creates that feeling as well.
Because Duncan did your first book as well.
He
right?
did. Yeah, he
and
did.
Just, and, you know, all the...
He's asked me to write in couplets now for the next one.
Write a novella. No.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you publish with Human Cry.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about that? That must be... quite amazing.
It has been really amazing. I just, because they are so supportive of letting me do, like, of trusting me, you know, of letting me do what I want to do. Obviously within reason, you know, like the book is edited and and there were some very kind but firm suggestions about things that really weren't working, which was good. But yeah, they've been amazing at letting me experiment. And when I said to Chloe, because after the first book, and I had a few of these poems, and then I said, look, I really want to write a book of just long poems.
Mm.
And she was like, do it, just go for it. And that was, you know, it's really freeing, because I was probably going to do it anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't going to not do it, but to have the support and know that when it, you know, when it was finished, she would want to work with it and you know, and publish it.
Mm. And you worked with Amy Brown, eh?
Yeah, she was she was in my master's year. So this,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so this has actually been really lucky that she, you know, that she, her and Chloe have a, you know, a close friendship and relationship, and Amy, she edited this book, but she's known my work for so many years,
yeah,
and she is such an excellent you know, excellent poet and academic herself, but also a really, really good reader.
Mm.
And so she knows what I want my work to do.
Mm.
And, I mean, she came up with the title for the first book.
Fantastic. Best book ever.
Yeah, and she also suggested cutting a few lines off the very final poem in that book, which was perfect. You know, so it's just those things that you can't see because you've been so close to it for so long.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, well, obviously, like, I feel like these are my books. I feel like they also belong to all these different people and to, you know, a writer's group and to just, yeah, and to my, I mean, this one here is work is dedicated to my, to Chloe and my doctoral supervisors as well.
Mm.
Because I, you know, I wouldn't have gotten there. Mm. Or it would have been a book, but it wouldn't have been what I wanted it to be because they really, really pushed me into places I did not want to be pushed.
Yeah.
Called literary criticism. That was a place I had no interest in whatsoever.
And what were the advantages of going to that place?
Well, it just, it, I think it gave me a much, because my undergrad was in fine arts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of my, I've never done an English degree.
Yeah.
And so it made me be able to read other poets, so like this Anne Kennedy book, and see what she was doing in terms of commenting about poetry.
Mm.
So I could suddenly see, instead of just looking at the single poem, I could see it within like a broader tradition of poetry and broader kind of thought about poetry. And because my thesis, the critical part of my thesis was on poet Robert Haas, and so much of his writing is about writing.
Mm,
it's about what does a poem do. Yeah. And all of his stuff, you know, has that kind of the thinking animal, humanist thinking animal in it. So much sex in it. And I'm always really pleased with people who can write really well about sex. And Anne Kennedy does. There's a really wonderful, I'm just going to read you this bit in here, when Moss and Paul first start, you know, first park up together. The lines are, her hands newly created, as in a laboratory by a mad scientist, now lying the length of his penis, it's sort of pet rabbit.
So good.
Because it could go so sentimental, and then suddenly I'm like, pet rabbit. It's just such a perfect image.
Really perfect. And I think, you know, that's the other thing about this book is that it's a funny book and it's a sexy
book. Yeah, it is.
It's such a sexy book. And I was thinking, because when I was reading it, I was thinking about the rise that good sex writing gives me. And I just think, wow, you know, that's as, you know, exciting for me as feeling sad or feeling happy.
Yeah.
I think that...
it doesn't shy away from the entirety of the human experience.
Yeah.
And that I also, what I loved in it was, so, you know, there's you know, in writing about in Moss trying to get condoms and about her forgetting condoms, then having to take the morning after pill and then her feeling sick at work. And, you know, that is an experience I remember as a young woman.
Yeah.
So it's really, it's like grounded in these real events that young women can go through, and at the same time she's a giantess, so it's that wonderful play.
That was the thing that I just loved about it, like there was all that, and you were never allowed to forget that this is someone who is possibly of mythical birth, who you know what I mean, like has a long tradition of legend behind them, and you know, like and I think that's what was so interesting for me with the figure of the brother. You know, that...
Oh, Forrest.
Yeah, Forrest. Oh my God, he's just so great and just so wonderful. And that beautiful interaction that happens between Paul and him, you know, like, it's just, I don't know, it's just... This is the thing that I found exciting about the book, is that it would have been so easy just, like, how can I explain it? I think what it shows is how much a poem can hold. Like, sometimes you think... You know, right, oh, okay, I will write a poem about one theme. You know, like, it would be enough to say, here's a tall woman that falls in love with a, you know, small guy.
Yeah.
But in there's the relationship with the mother that wants her to marry a, you know, is a bit disappointed when the giant comes to the door. There's the really interesting stuff about the English lectures, you know, and where Ulysses sits in the scheme of things. Yeah. And then there's this wonderful stuff with the
I also really like the librarians.
Oh, the librarians are fantastic, aren't they?
I mean, they are kind of like the stereotypical, you know, like bun on top of their head cardigan librarians, but they are also really wonderful, and they're really kind of feisty and like kind of also slightly dirty in a very polite way.
There's that wonderful bit, I don't know, like I might be misremembering, but I do love the bit when they're excited because it feels almost like Emma or something out of Austin where they think they've found her a man and it's the giant that she doesn't like, you know, from her English person. I just think, God, like coming at it as a reader, that's not true. I read a lot of poetry, but coming at it with my novel mind on, you know, it gives so much more than a lot of novels.
Yeah. And I think that, and I know that I say this to my students a lot when they'll write a poem and it only does one thing. And really a poem has to, I feel, do 10 things because it is many less words, you know? So. So you have to do a lot. You have to make everything count.
Yeah.
So all of those words, all of the punctuation, all of the space.
Yeah.
It has to be purposeful. It has to do something, which of course they don't want to hear.
No. But as a absolutely failed poet, I know that it's very easy to do that one trick pony thing. You know, like it's very well not easy. God, I keep saying easy. Fuck, it used to take me days to write these things. You know, weeks, months, years to write these things. But in the end, all they would do is just one thing. And it is really interesting to try. And the thing is that I'm always interested with writing as well, especially like you talked about teaching. There's that weird thing where you... Do you think about audience? Like, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you're writing thinking, I want it to mean this and this. But then there's that weird thing where you're thinking psychologically, especially in poems, I think, like, typographically, psychologically, how do I lead those people to that thing that I'm thinking?
Yeah, I don't think about a particular audience. Yeah, so yeah. I don't think I'm writing for these people.
Yeah.
But I do think, how am I going to communicate this idea to someone who's reading it? Or what is my best chance?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it'll be read in all sorts of different ways. That's why it's so fascinating reading reviews
I can imagine.
Of a book, because sometimes they can be way off, and then sometimes somebody will just get exactly what you mean. But, I don't think that matters, really. I just want somebody to have an experience. You know, so the poem itself and that's why I want it to look a particular way, is an experience. You know, it's not... Yeah. I mean, you have it in the book, but it is that 10 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever you take to read it that stays with you. And then it is like a feeling in the body, I think, of you know, a really good piece of writing.
Yeah.
And I think about this with novels or, you know, collections of poetry that I've read. A lot of the time I can't tell you what they're about.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the plot,
but
I can tell you how I feel about having read them. So I'm trying to... create a reaction in a reader, and also I definitely want them to think. I want them to question things. So I try in my poems, I try to gently place things in front of a reader. So, you know, there are lots of in my book, there's, you know, there's a transgender woman, there is an asexual woman, there's a who's part of a, you know, lesbian relationship. There's lots of different play with gender and sexuality, and you know, there's speculative poetry, so something set in the future, and, you know, in that future it's slightly different. You know, there's a melanoma epidemic across the world, and the polar bears have died out, and, you know, these sorts of things. And so I want these like little seeds to be planted in the reader to then think, you know, what world am I living in? Who am I in that world? What is, again, air quotes, normal? What are my biases? You know, all those sorts of
things. It's really interesting because I've been thinking a lot, like, I loved what you said before about what is poetry for? And, you know, I do think about that. And I'm really interested, like, as you've been talking, I've been trying to think how you would do these things that you're talking about in photography. And I just keep I keep wondering, I've always wondered this, and I've never asked you, and now I'm going to ask you in public, which is bad. But I'm just wondering, why are you not a photographer, do you think? Why do you think you're
a writer?
A writer?
That, I think it's a good question. I don't know if it's, I don't know if I know the answer to it. I don't think I was a bad photographer. Obviously, I went to art school and managed to get a degree, so... Mm. But I don't think I was a good photographer either. I just don't think it was my medium. Mm. And I'd always written, but... I think that was one of the stories I told myself. Like, all through school, I was, like, the girl who could draw, the girl who could do art.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was the artist, and yeah. that was my identity. And it, I remember when I finished my photography degree, and I just put my camera away, and then years later I sold it. And now I have an iPhone, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Sweet. But it took me, it was really hard to let it go, yeah. even though I was writing poetry and... to let go of that idea of myself.
Yeah.
And to let, or kind of, I kind of hate to use the term, that my genuine self rise yeah. up and be more in charge. Yeah. And it, I mean, until the point where I did the PhD, and I think I said this, like I did an interview with Paula Green for work, and I was saying that it was like I was writing on the side, but I wasn't looking at it. I was always like, you know, I was doing my job, I was working in IT, I was doing all these different things, because it was like, if I looked at it, maybe I'd actually have to do something about it. Maybe I'd have to commit to it. And I knew at some point I would have to commit to it, but it was very scary. And I know a lot of people, often women, who will not say, I'm a writer,
mm.
who have that real, you know, like, what do you do? They say, oh, I do some
teaching,
writing. You know, like yeah, it's really hard, I think, for people, because then you're saying, this is worthwhile
yes.
to read. Yeah. You know, this is something that is good, and that yeah. So I think I'm not a photographer because I wasn't very good. But I also think it wasn't my thing. Mm. You know, I think people have their things that they do, whatever they are. And that writing was it. I could create the worlds that I wanted to create,
because that's what I keep thinking in here. Like, I've been doing a bit of work with a photographer at the moment, and I'm doing some work with the Fiona Partington thing, and I was thinking about how often it's hard to leap around in worlds the way that you do in work. Like, that was one of the real enjoyments for me, was that I'm in the future, in a playground, in the woods, you know, like, you know, I really enjoyed that about it, you know, like, I'm in this consciousness, I'm challenging, you know, like, how do I feel, you know, what is, you know, Hannah Moana said it so brilliantly in that first poem, you know, that idea of the go home, you know, like,
yeah.
you know, that dreadful racism that you get here, and like, I think that there is something interesting about point of view. Like, I was thinking a little bit about Gregory Crudson, and I was thinking maybe, but then even he, the tone remains very similar. Like, if you see a room of his photography, the tone stays quite similar. But this does, I'm not saying they feel disconnected, but it's a real pleasure.
Yeah.
To move in and out. How do you work on them? Do you work on one until it's finished?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't jump between them. I mean, obviously when I edit.
Yeah.
You know, like, I edit it as a whole. Yeah, I work on one, and I'm really systematic as well. So I'll get an idea of what I want to write, of the, you know, the broad story, and then I will research a lot beforehand, because a lot of my ideas spark up out of the research. So for the one that's set in Longyearbyen in Norway, I spent heaps of time on Google Earth walking around the town and just like taking notes and reading about the history, and then from the language of, you know, of those discoveries, little bits will spark, and then that will start turning into things. And then I actually plan out, like plot out the poem. So I go, you know, right, this is a section where she walks up the hill to visit the gulls, you know. This is a section where he's in the vault doing this. And then I start to build it and just...
Mm.
So, yeah, it is kind of a little bit like problem solving for me, you know. So I go, how can I show this emotion or this idea? But also it's just going with it, like trying to shut off my critical brain and just let it go and just and also to not stick to the plan. So if something's not working, just to be able to let it go instead of hammering away, because there's nothing worse than a poem that I've worked on, you know, like that is not working, that I'm trying to make work. It never has that freshness, that genuineness to it. It always feels a bit labored. Unfortunately.
I was just asking this on Twitter yesterday. I was just wondering, like, when do you give up? You know what I mean? Like, I am a flogger of dead horses. You know, like, I'm working on something that I've written. I think I'm up to, like, the 9th or 10th full draft.
And
the first five were completely different novels. Like, they were just like, oh, yeah, now we've got four people in it. Now we've got three. But I just, how do you... I liked what you said about freshness of feeling, you know, because I think that's the thing that I'm finding harder and harder in teaching, is that a lot of what I'm doing, a lot of when I know that I'm right, is because it's making a noise inside of me, and you can't explain that. You can't sort of say, oh, you'll know, you know, and I mean, I don't know if I did know 20 years ago or 10 years ago, but I don't know, like, I really liked what you said about freshness, you know. Like,
I think that's something that you learn.
Yeah,
through the experience. I mean, it took me a long time to come to, like, I really don't think I will write a short poem ever again.
Awesome.
I just don't think it's going to happen.
It excites me as a reader of your work.
I don't think I could. I don't, you know, like, what I'm interested in. I say this now, and then, like, you know, three years, I've got a
book of sonnets.
Book of sonnets, yeah, just what I was going to say. As soon as I say I'm not going to do something, it happens.
Well, when
I talk to my students, I say, well, I've been, you know, writing this and I'm trying to, you know, show this to the reader. And I say, well, you might be showing them, usually telling them, but you might be showing them, but you also need to make them feel it. I said, try to make them feel it. And I mean, that's the same thing. I think that, I can't remember who said it to me. I think it was probably Damien, who was my MA supervisor. But that, if it is not surprising me, it will not surprise a reader.
That's so high test, Mr. Wilkins. Oh my god!
I think
my heart a little bit.
Yeah. So I think sometimes I think, oh, I could write a poem about this, or this is quite interesting. But if I don't feel that real like draw to it, then I don't go near it. And now, I mean, I do have like a few poems, like the collection that I wrote for my doctoral thesis. So a couple of the poems are in work. Lots have been published in journals. And then there are like these strays that I think, I could do something with these. And then I think, really, I probably shouldn't. I should just put them away. They did their job, you know, of being part of my PhD. And
set them free.
And then, yeah, I should not try to, you know, like, kind of whip them, beat them into some sort of form to be published.
Yeah.
So.
Oh my goodness. I was just thinking, like.
But I have to say, with your novel, it's easier to stop working on a poem.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, if I've only written like three pages, I can let it go.
Whereas if I'm sitting looking at 70,000 words going, one thing I'm really interested in, because it sounds like, I love the idea that there's all this research and thinking and everything.
So much.
And then
so much
squashed,
research.
Almost like juiced into these tiny little things. And I've been thinking a lot about that. Like, I often write about places I haven't been. And I write about places I have been, you know, because I haven't travelled much. So if I only write about places I've been, it would be a very small universe. But I was wondering, I love the idea that, I'm very in love with Google Earth, and I love the idea that there is this space between the real place and my version of that real place. And I just love it. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between writing somewhere you've physically stood and somewhere you haven't physically stood?
Yeah, well, I think it is really, it's difficult. I mean, that's like another magic trick, to convince someone that you've been there.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest compliments I've had about work is that my my friend Mike showed it to his girlfriend, and she lived in Africa for a while. I don't know if she actually went to Addis Ababa, but I think she's lived in Ethiopia. And she said, has she been there? This is just how it is.
Hey.
So, yeah, that for me is like, yes, that achieved what I wanted.
Yeah.
I think writing, in a way, writing somewhere you haven't been, there's a lot of freedom because you're not bogged down by your experience of the place.
Yeah.
So you get to build the experience in service of the poem.
Mm.
So that is good, but also you haven't been there. Yeah. So you don't have the experience of the place to draw on. So that's, just a lot of Google Earth. I just read as much as I can. And just, of like news reports, like BBC news reports and stuff, lots of stuff on Wikipedia, just YouTube videos of people, driving around in a taxi or like all those sorts of things, just to give that experience. Because the problem also of, say, writing a poem in Wellington is it's so familiar to me that I can sometimes forget that it may not be familiar to the reader. So that is, but then of course I have all the experience of like the flora and fauna and everything. It's different, for every different writer, but it's really important that everything is as factual as possible. So every single animal and plant and bump in the landscape and name, street names and everything will be as factual as I can make it.
Because I was just thinking, I loved what you talked about problem solving. I was just saying that to someone yesterday about how this, and I think it was Alice Munro maybe, who talked about short stories kind of being her Sudoku, I think that's like you are incredibly talented as far as sewing and knitting and all that stuff goes, and I am not, but I just feel like this often is my sewing and knitting. I remember my mother-in-law saying that to me once. She said, oh, now that you've finished study you'll be able to take up sewing or something, and I was just like, oh, now I've finished studying, I think I just want to go and write silly little stories, and I think that there is something, that problem solving stuff, and I think you're right, like, I mean, I sort of don't find it as big a challenge if I'm allowed to make up that there's a pine over there or that there's a, a twiddly bird in the sky or something.
And that's, I think, in a part why I like to have the, because I draw on real events and real people and then fictionalise them to a degree, I think I'm going to do that with the third book as well, which has already started to, kind of like ferment a bit in my mind.
That's fantastic.
To bubble.
Because, I mean, that is like...
Because it's a constraint.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
And also a starting point.
Yeah.
For inspiration.
Yeah.
And also because I don't want to write about myself, really.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously some of the poems in the book are autobiographical, but I find... I'm interested in other people's very varied experiences of the world that have nothing to do with, what it is like to be, a Pākehā woman in her late 30s living in Wellington.
Mm.
Not that that's not a, interesting and valid experience, but I know that really well because I'm doing it every day. So I want to, I'm really... Yeah, I think I'm just really nosy, curious.
I totally agree. Like, people confuse me. Like, I find people really, really confusing. And one way into them that I find is to write, most of my stories start with, why the hell did they do that? People will do something mean, or they'll do something, self-destructive, I understand self-destructive a lot, actually, but, they'll do something, and I'm sort of like, why did they do that? And that's often where the story starts, and... I don't know, a lot of people that teach creative writing in prison say that it can help build empathy for that reason, but I don't know if it's got as big a moral, agenda as that, but I think that's what I find really refreshing in your work as well, is that as much as I am in love with confessional poetry, I love confessional poetry, but
one of my favourite poets is Sharon Olds, she's like the queen of confessional poetry.
Fantastic, hey?
Yeah, I could just read her all day.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's so good, eh? But I do like the way this moves around. Hey, I was just thinking, it hasn't occurred to me before, but I went to a creative writing course, and now I teach creative writing. You went to a creative writing course,
yes.
And now you teach creative writing. I'm wondering,
is this what happens?
Yeah. God, we're the lucky ones. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just wonder, what is teaching? And I was just thinking, Anne Kennedy teaches as well.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, what do you think teaching gives to writing? Like, I often wonder.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Well, I've been teaching at Massey for years now.
Oh, fantastic.
And I teach stage one and two. Mm-hmm. So we're pretty much the basics. Although some of the poetry and the short stories that come out of there, just amazing. They just blows my mind how talented those students are. I feel like I learn as much as they do.
Mm.
And also there's something to be said for, because every year I read the lectures all over again, and they're written by Brian Walpert and Tom Conroy. And those lectures are so good. And it just reminds me of the basics, which I think can be really easy to forget when you are trying to construct what is, like a multifaceted, many moving parts, long narrative poem.
Mm.
To how to create an image and how to create perception, and I think teaching's been really important.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that the other day. I'm going to credit this to Damien as well, but I'm pretty sure it was
Damien's getting a lot of credit.
Damien, so he deserves. But he said to me something like, the reason that the workshop works, and similar to the way you guys are teaching at Massey, the reason that it works is that everyone's having the same problems. It's just that some people have been, the facilitator possibly has been having the same problems for longer, yes. and it's just that wonderful thing that when you're reading other people's writing, and I think this is why these feedback, because you guys do feedback at Massey as well, like students,
it's pretty much all feedback.
And I just really love that idea that when I, as a, I always think of myself as a learning writer, as a student writer, me as a writer reads another writer's work, I'm reading it through the lens of the problems I'm having at this particular time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And
I'm sort of like, this year it's all, I just can't seem to stay away from point of view. I'm always going, oh, this is interesting how you've done this point of view.
Yeah.
And, obviously.
It's your concerns,
current concerns come through. And you can see that happening in the class. There's someone who is really interested in characterizations. There's someone that's experimenting with big, broad point of views and stuff like that. I just think it's a wonderful thing. What do you think the MA gave you? What do you think doing the MA gave you?
I was such a green writer going into that.
Me too.
Yeah, I'd never done a workshop before, and I just had no idea what I was doing. I think it taught me how to take criticism.
Yeah.
Was the most important thing.
Yeah.
And it just showed me how, because I after the MA finished, I didn't write for about 6 months,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
The trauma.
Yeah.
The trauma. because it was for someone who had never, really shared my work. I'd only had a few poems published.
Yeah.
It was really confronting, but also amazing. I had a really wonderful, supportive MA group.
Yeah.
I think it was just the start. And I did talk to one of the MA students last week, and she's just about to put in her folio. And I said to her, just remember, this is the first step. This is not the last step.
Yeah.
The submission of your folio. Because it does seem massive at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's so hard to tell what it taught me.
Yeah.
I just think it really...
And you got to know some really good people too, eh?
That's huge, the relationships. Like at the launch of work, Therese Lloyd was also in my MA year.
Yeah.
And that's just as important as anything is the writing community you're in. I'm sure some writers write completely in isolation.
Yeah.
But I don't know any of them.
Yeah.
Well, obviously.
Because they're in isolation.
Yeah. I find it so essential. I don't know if you were at the workshop for Ghosts, the original.
No, I wasn't.
For listeners, Pip and I are in the same writing workshop. But when I workshopped that poem, I thought I'd finished it. And so I'd just written the poems in three parts. The first part is from Fowler's perspective. The second part is from his wife, Diane's perspective. And then the third part is from sort of almost both of their perspectives, and it's set in 2070, so very far in the future at the end of Fowler's life. So I've written only the Fowler part, and I was like, oh, this poem's finished. I'm feeling so pleased with myself.
Aren't I amazing?
Yeah, aren't I great? Awesome. which, you know, never trust that feeling.
Mm.
And then and then everyone read it and they said, this is really good, we love this, you know, there are problems here and here and here, and yeah. we don't believe this, and where's the rest of it?
Oh no.
And I was like, what do you mean? They said, this should be a whole book. You could write a whole book from this poem. And I was like, well, it has to... I'm not going to, but... They said, you need to bring us more. And so I wrote the next part, and then I wrote the third part, and they were right. Mm. And I could not, you know, I couldn't see it. I couldn't... So I just being, you know, they pushed me. It's that pushing, because it's really hard. It's really painful to push.
And it's kind of like, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I was just thinking, like, so many times I've gone into workshop thinking, you know, yeah. I'm so clever. It's just going to be, I have a friend who was at art school when I was doing the MA, and she used to say the same thing, you know, she'd present for critique and she'd be like, I think what they're going to say is, go home, you're amazing. Yeah. I said, yeah, I always wait for that. But I do agree with what you're saying. Like, suddenly... someone can crack open new possibilities out of it. And I just remember, you know, like I remember someone, when I took something to a workshop, saying, how about this isn't a coming of age story? And I was like, fuck it. That is the only structure I had to hang this on. And now, you know, I was just thinking about those great first days at, was that at Wordsworth Street?
Tennyson.
Tennyson.
Yeah.
The wrong poet. But yeah, at the Zipper Factory.
Yes, yes.
Oh my God.
Which
was so much fun.
I think it's been, I mean, for me, our writing group has been amazing in terms of, you know, giving really valuable feedback, but also feeling like there is the support there through the years.
Mm.
And that, I think, has just given me a huge amount of confidence to write what I wanted to write.
Mm.
Because a lot of the times I've thought, you know, like I whisper quietly to myself, or I have in the past, I don't do it now, you know, oh, like I really want to write these poems about death row inmates, but that sounds really awful, you know, like, and then it took me, you know, like for those poems it took years to write them.
Yeah.
And yeah, just I think having those sort of trusted networks of readers, like my friend Mike, who I was talking about before, he's my first reader for everything.
Yeah.
So once I finish something, I send it to him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, you know, it's not like he's giving me huge amounts of feedback, but just the act of someone reading it and saying, oh, this is, you know, have you thought about this? And starts that, it's that idea that, you know, my poem is only part me, and then there are all these, all these other, like, people pushing at it in different ways.
It's really funny that thing you say, because I feel like about 3 or 4 years ago, I remember thinking, oh, we're getting to know each other too well. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I was thinking, oh, we're getting to know each other's writing too well. And then I was thinking, now, I think that's the strongest thing about it, is that I am getting a sense of what turns Sarah Bainbridge on, and I get a sense of what turns Lawrence on, and I get a sense of what turns Tina on, and I get a sense of what turns you on, and there's something really, I think we've become better readers for each other. Oh, I don't know, I really think we have though.
Like, I think so, but I also think we are becoming more skilled over the years.
This is the other thing, isn't it? Started so green, and
when we first started, there were nobody in the group had published a book.
No.
I think maybe Amy was, her poetry collection was the first, and I think then Ellie's book came out.
That's right.
And then she left us.
Yeah.
For international fame.
But we still just do visits.
Really amazing. I mean, and that's what I would say, like, to an MA class going out now and, you know, to continue those writing groups. And that's what I say to the students I teach, even though they're spread all throughout the world, because I teach distance.
Yeah.
There are people who live in the same cities, or who, you know, who make connections in the forums, and who can continue to work together and workshop together.
So true, so true. We've gone miles from the time of the giants.
We have
got the giant stare. Is there anything else we need to say about it? I was just thinking.
I just think everyone should read it.
I think that is the going away present.
I've never read another book of poetry like this. It does so much with so many different ideas, with language, with story, with character, but it does it so lightly. And it is incredibly funny.
I think it's one of the best New Zealand books. I think it's one of the best books I've read. Forget the New Zealand bit. Like, I just, it just, I was so surprised. Like, I knew it was going to be good because I have read her poetry before. I haven't read the novels, but I've read the poetry before and always enjoyed it. But it, and I sort of, in that horrible, you know, like, I thought I knew what I was getting, and what I was getting was so much more. Like, it just, I feel like it's, and it's already started to infiltrate my own writing. You know, that thing where you read a great book and you find yourself thinking, you know, da-da-da, you know. It's so good.
And I think it, what I quite like about her writing is that, and this is, I find, about, actually about Anne Kennedy herself, is that there is a, like, there's a quietness to it. You know, it's, and then you, after a while, you realise what incredible poise and strength and intelligence is under the surface. And that's when I was, you know, when you read the book, you're like, oh, this is really enjoyable, and so on and so on. And then you kind of get towards the end and it starts to build. I found, like, I could feel it in my body, like the ideas of it, and then it stays with you.
And it really does. This is the wrong word, but it has. I was going to say balls, but it's got chutzpah. You
it
know
has
what I mean?
Like,
it
ovaries.
Has, ovaries. That's what it has. But I mean, there's that wonderful thing where
it is. She's completely fearless.
Yes,
completely fearless about breaking, you know, all the rules of you know, of English, of you know, of write. You know, like, how could you write? If somebody said to me, oh, Sarah, can you write a book about, like, a kind of mythical giantess, but also have, you know, like, these really everyday, like, you know, condoms and libraries and, you know, those sorts of things, and a rugby match, could you write a whole rugby match in there? I could not imagine how I could do that.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's fucking brilliant. She's genius. And she's coming to Wellington.
She is.
We're very excited. She was announced as the, what do you call it? I think it's called the Victoria University Creative New Zealand Writing Fellow.
Something
like that. I think it's one of the best.
I hope she'll give some talks. And
it's one of the best things that happens in Wellington, eh? Like, with Randall House and that, and we start to get people from all over New Zealand.
Yeah,
coming, which
yeah,
is
it's
so
really good.
Great. It's really good. That's great. Now, so the next, do you want to tell me anything about the next book before we leave? Is it? I guess the only thing I'm interested in is that you obviously. I guess what I'm interested in is this goes out. There's a sense of relief.
Yes.
Do you start Do you start thinking writing again, or do you just go, I'm amazing, and sit in the sun for 2 months with it?
Unlikely. I have started thinking about the third book. I won't. I think I'll probably start writing it next year.
Nice.
But I have the characters, and I have kind of the story, and I have the idea for it.
Great.
I'm in that grind at the moment of trying to find some funding.
Oh, yeah. Yay!
And figuring out
I'll just get my case of money down here. I just want to give all the writers I love money, but I don't have any.
So it is the problem. I'm excited to write, and I think because there were 3 years between my first book and my second book.
Yeah.
And during that time was also, you know, trying to raise a small child and finish a PhD and do all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
But I don't have to do that now. No. I mean, I still have the child.
Yeah, yeah. He still has a new home.
He's bigger.
Yeah.
So it's easier. So I like the idea that I'm going to be able to read widely and spend more time. Like, like, with the problem solving, there's also something about crafting something really beautiful. And I think about, you know, like, people who are, like, carpenters or artists, you know, like, visual artists, and even, you know, like, we're getting a house painted at the moment, and our painter is, like, one of those old-school craftsmen. And there's something so satisfying about just crafting something that is as beautiful as you can make it. And so I think that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds fantastic. That sounds fantastic. I look forward to it.
Well, thank you.
I look forward to it a lot.
I think it's probably going to be really tough, but, you know.
Yeah. But
they all are.
They all are, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing that I find really exciting about your work, and sort of that insight that I get through Writers Group, is that every time you start a new project, it feels like starting a new, that can be a word, but I'm just thinking, you know, like, it's like, when I watch you, I think, oh, she got really good at figure skating. Oh, now she's going to take on skiing. Or, you know what I mean? Like, and I really enjoy that, because I think that the work really is rewarded from that. You know, I think, well, it excites me as a reader. I just think it's great.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.